map composed two to the n times. And again, why is it two to the n? It's because the period started at 1 and it kept doubling. So it goes 2, 4, 8, 16, etc. Okay, and so that means you want to solve the equation f of x equals 0, where f of x is equal to f to the 2 to the n of x minus x. Okay? So then at the end, there's a little digression of how you do that. And again, it's a nonlinear equation. And then I did the period 2 orbit just to show you that you didn't want to do it by hand. And then again, we did this Newton-Raphson method, which I got to last time. And I went through all of it, but I forgot to draw the picture. Okay, so here is the picture of Newton-Raphson. Okay, I drew this part of the picture. So you have some function. This is f of x. This is x. And what you've got is you're looking for, and so now if you hearken back to your notes from last time, you're looking for the solution. OK, f of x equals 0. But what you've got is you've got the, you have a guess, OK? And everything is drawn, so this will work fabulously. You have your guess, which is the point x naught, all right? And what you do then is you just take, I want colored chalk, but I don't have any. OK, you take the slope, OK? OK, so this is, sorry, we're working in capital F, F prime of x naught, okay? And then you drop all the rest of the terms. I'm not going to write out the equation again just because it's boring. Not that, no, we won't get into a relative boringness conversation. But, okay, you take the slope and then you just ignore all the rest of the terms and then you just find where that slope, you know, you have f of x. You say, okay, well, let's take the slope. We'll see where it intersects. And that's the new guess, x naught. Okay, sorry, x1. Okay, and so the equation is x1 is equal to x naught minus f of x naught divided by f prime of x naught. Okay, and to see that, all right, this is f of x naught, right? Okay, and then here's your slope. And so so what you have is that f prime of x naught is equal to x naught minus x1, right? That's in the denominator, and the numerator is f of x naught, okay? And then you just solve that for x1. Sorry, I'll put it this way, f of x naught, x minus x1. Okay, so then you solve that, and then you get this. Okay, so that's what Newton-Raphson does, and I just forgot to say it when I did that. Okay, so is it clear what the thing is? It's a very simple approximation, but it's a simple scheme, but there you go. And then the next thing is then you want to make it better and better, and then you've got x2, and you just do the same thing again, x1 minus f of x1 divided by f prime of x1, and that's your next approximation. And again, the Sternberg notes go into detail of, you know, how fast it converges, and it's all quadratic, and it's all great. Okay? So that's what I wanted to say that I had forgotten to say about the Newton-Raphson. So it should be clear what's going on. Okay? It's a very simple thing. But it's always good to draw a picture. All right. So there was one other thing I was going to do that was... Okay, so then I think that was the only thing which I absolutely forgot to do. And so now what I wanted to do was to actually talk about how you compute the high-order orbits, okay? So again, the thing that you have when you're computing these orbits, I think I'll leave this, and then I'll just erase this, is it's not... There are two things about finding these orbits, okay? The one is... that you got to start off at the right place. And then the second thing is that you need to have the right value of mu. So even though the map looks like it has only one variable, it has two variables. Because if you're looking for an orbit of a given period, then you got to have mu in the right place, okay? And when you start off, that's not a big deal because the regions in mu, which are correspond to each orbit, to each period, you know, are not that small. But the high period orbits, as you will see and as you will compute, are stable in smaller and smaller regions of mu. And in fact, the width of the regions goes down geometrically. I mean, in some sense, that's the whole point. And so you really got to know, so you have to find mu. It's not enough to, you got to find a spot on the orbit that takes you to the right place, and you have to have the right value of mu together. And this seems sort of tough, but there's actually a very simple way of doing the computation that follows from the following fact, which is, last time I did this business of the stability is determined by the derivative of the map. Okay, f prime. Wait, I'll put it this way: d by dx naught of f to the 2 to the n of x naught. We'll put it that way. Okay, and again, this is just. Again, because we're looking for, this whole discussion is about high period orbits. Okay, so you're trying to do this thing, and again, if the absolute value of this thing is less than 1, then it's stable, and if it's bigger than 1, then it's unstable. Okay, but what happens is if you look, and you can do period 1, period 2, and again, numerically, you get to check that this is true. What happens is that if I plot this thing, I'll call this thing, lambda. Okay, I just want a name for it. Okay, over the course of the region in mu where an orbit is stable, so we'll call this thing mu min and mu max. Okay, and this isn't great notation because I haven't told you the period of the orbit, but it doesn't matter. They're all the same. And what happens is that when an orbit first becomes stable, this derivative is 1. Okay. The old orbit, and then what happens is then when it goes unstable, the derivative is minus 1, all right? And the derivative is a continuous function because we did the chain rule last time, and the derivative is just the product of the derivatives of a quadratic function, and so it's nice and continuous. And so what happens is when this thing goes to minus 1, then the period doubles, but then again you take minus 1 times minus 1 and you get 1 again. So the longer period orbit then has a eigenvalue of 1. The derivative is 1. And then again, the same thing, as you keep increasing mu, then it goes down, it hits minus 1. When it hits minus 1, the period doubles. Okay. And again, the whole point of these Sternberg notes is it goes into great detail about the generality of this thing. And if you're interested, again, the fact that this is sort of a general thing is nice, okay. But we're not going to worry about proving it because I have these wonderful notes that I can refer you to that are really very nice and complete. But we're going to use the fact that, if you have a function that starts at 1 and ends at minus 1 and is continuous, then, I don't know what the hell the theorem's called. It's called something, right? Mean value theorem, it has to hit 0. Okay, if it starts at 1, ends at minus 1, goes through 0, it has to, there must be a value of the argument for which the function itself is 0. So that's, I think it's the mean value, it's not the mean, is it? Okay, mean value theorem. Okay, so the point is that there's a value of mu, okay, and where this derivative is 0, okay? And so it's called S for superstable. Okay. Now, why is it superstable? It's superstable because again, there is this thing where you say, all right, if I start slightly away from the fixed point, and then the eigenvalue tells you like how quickly you go in, and it basically to the linear approximation, you start away from the fixed point and you go right back to the fixed point. So actually, it turns out the convergence to the fixed point. Is the fastest at the superstable point. So that's the sense in which it's superstable, that perturbations fall off, perturbations die out at most quickly at the superstable point. Okay, so the question of superstable is a question of orbits, but now already we're sort of moving our way into the parameter space where we're thinking much more about how things vary as a function of mu. Okay, so so why do we care? All right, well, the point is, you recall that this derivative, okay, so now let's look at the derivative. Okay, so basically, you know, for each, I'm filling in the thing I forgot to say. Okay, so for each, for each n, okay, and what I mean by that, again, is the period is equal to 2 to the n, there is a mu for which lambda is equal to 0, where this derivative is equal to 0, okay? All right, but now let's look at the derivative, okay? So we've got d by dx naught of f 2 to the n of x naught, okay? And that is just equal to, okay, f prime of x naught, f prime of x1, dot, 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 just the product f prime of x 2 to the n minus 1, okay? So it's just the product of the derivatives by the chain rule. Okay, so if this thing is equal to 0, that means that one of these has to be 0, right? And now this is just a function of this, okay, but recall, f prime of x is equal to what? Mu minus 2 mu x, right? There's only one point at which this derivative is 0. It is 0 only when x is equal to 1/2. Okay? Is this clear? All right. So the point is that if you know, you know that in each interval there is a value of mu at which the derivative is 0, and you know that if the derivative is 0, there is an x on the orbit that is at exactly x equals 1/2. Okay, so that means you don't have to find the starting point, because you know the starting point if you're looking for a superstable orbit. Okay, you know that x equals 1/2 is on that orbit. Okay, so, and that is a wonderful thing. Okay, and is that clear? Because again, this is somehow the thing that is, you know, this is the difference between, you know, you plot this thing and you're trying to judge where the bifurcations are, and it's sort of, you know, and as the periods get long, it's really hard to see if they close, whatever. Whereas by actually solving for the high period orbits by looking for the fixed point of the map composed of itself umpteen times, you can just get much higher accuracy. And but then you say, oh, but I have to look at two parameters. But now you only have to look at one parameter, because you know your initial condition of the orbit. You're looking for the orbit at x that starts off at x equals 1/2. And now all you got to do is you got to find the mu. You know, there's a mu for each orbit period. You know, I draw the same picture for every period doubled orbit, but then, you know, there's a value at mu where this happens. So first you have to find period 2, period 4, period 8, et cetera. Okay. Now, it's not entirely trivial. Okay, so this is a wonderful thing. So basically what you do then is you say, let me just finish this and then I'll get into why it's not entirely trivial. So what you've got then is you have your function f of mu, okay? No longer is x, you're not worried about x anymore, because you know your x. You're going to start off at x equals 1/2. So your function is f, this should be 2 to the little n. Big N is 2 to the little n, I'm sorry. All right, this should be consistent in the notes, with the notes, okay? So this is f to the n, and mu is this little subscript of 1/2. Minus 1/2. Okay, and that's the function that you want to be 0, and that function is a function only of mu. Okay, and then the problem is when you're looking at high period orbits is that there are lots and lots and lots of solutions. So here, if I look at my function, I haven't actually plotted the function, but this is for purposes of argument. Okay, you just have a thing that looks like this, right? And you got to find the right 0. Okay, and so. And you know you have lots of spurious zeros. This is why I did this sort of the period 2 case, because remember, the fixed points are still there when you have period 2, and the period 2 orbit is still there when you've got period 4, et cetera. It's just that they're unstable. And Newton-Raphson doesn't care whether the thing's stable or not. It just cares whether it's a solution, right? So what happens is that there are many solutions to this, that all of the lower period orbits are also solutions of this equation. So you always have to find the next solution. You have to find the solution that didn't exist for the lower periods, okay? And in practice, you do that by using the fact that that you sort of know where the next solution's going to be. Okay. So so that's how that works. So, but there are lots and lots of solutions, and you know, and one thing you have to be careful about is to know that you found the right one. Okay, so here's your function. And now the only thing that you have to do when you're doing Newton-Raphson, right, is you just need to take the derivative, right? Because, you know, and again, we wrote down everything I wrote down about Newton-Raphson, my variable was x, but now my variable is mu, so the only thing that's the slightest bit non-trivial about this, aside from the multiple solutions, is your variable is mu. It's not x anymore. So just so that you don't get confused, I will just, you know, say a couple of words about it. So I mean the couple of words, if I were that I wrote in the notes, or well, you just use the chain rule, okay? But I'll just do a case, and hopefully you'll see how trivial it all is. Okay, so the point is that I'm taking d by d mu, right, of f to the 2 to the n of a half minus a half, okay? Well, we'll forget the half because, you know, obviously I take d by d mu and that doesn't do anything. So this is what I have. Okay, and so let me just do the, sorry?
So this is 2 in power n? Small n.
Yeah, okay, you should be aware, okay? Anything, the n's, I think the notes are okay, but I have a tendency to, sorry. Yeah, that's little n, thanks. Okay, so anyway, let me just say, let's just go on the orbit. Think about it going down the orbit, okay? So let's say so we have x0 is equal to a half, okay? And now I want d by d mu of x1, okay? And that's mu x0, 1 minus x0, d by d mu. And that is equal to x0, 1 minus x0, right? Because x0 is a half. Yes?
Sorry. Is there like an easier reason why it doesn't, instead of going from 1 to negative 1, go from 1 and then up again?
I'm trying to think. Is there an easy reason? So if you read these Sternberg notes, I mean, so this is this thing. It says that if the Schwarzschild derivative is always negative, and they introduces the Schwarzschild derivative, which has something to do with the third derivative and second derivative, if that is true, then this happens. So it's sort of this thing, if you have a function, here the third derivative of the function is zero, okay, so the Schwarzschild derivative has some sort of, you know, more simple form. Okay, but basically, again, if you have a one-dimensional map under fairly common conditions, this is what happens. Okay, but whether the notes, this is what's wrong with math at some level, right? Because he says, well, this is true, you know, if the function satisfies the following condition, which the logistic map does, then you get this, and it's proven, right? But now you're asking me why is that true? And to be honest, that doesn't mean there isn't a way to see it without doing any work, but I don't know what it is. Okay, so I think that's the right way of saying it. But again, it's quite general, but I don't have intuition about it, which is why I sort of said let's put these notes up there, because I can always refer you to them in the sense of, you know, it's not just made up, but it's, you know, not intuitively obvious. Okay, but again, you know, this is one of the things that you can do is you can just compute it and see that it's true. And then again, it's been proven that it's the generic thing, but I didn't get any intuition out of those notes in terms of why it's true. Okay. All right. Okay, so, so I'm just doing this thing. Okay, so this is trivial. Okay, then I have d by d mu of x2, okay, and I have d by d mu of mu, x1, 1 minus x1, and that's equal to x1, 1 minus x1, taking d by d mu part, plus mu df dx1 dx1 d mu, right? So then you get 1 minus 2x1 dx1 d mu. Okay? And this you just computed up here. Okay. So you can see, you just make a little loop, all right? You do this, and then when you do x2, everything, you just go down your thing, and again, you do x1, and then you do x2, you do x3, and so that's the only thing you needed to know, is you needed to know d by d mu of x to the 2 to the n, so then you have to multiply 2 to the n derivatives together. But you had to anyway, right? Okay. But what happens is you have this thing that you also have to add, all right? So the only trick in the thing, once you've done this, okay. And so now you have f of x and you have f prime of x, and then you just use the Newton-Raphson, and then you can do your homework, okay? Did I have anything? Let me just make sure I did everything I wanted to say. Oh no, I didn't. Yeah.
Is there some special form to the polynomials in mu that appear in front of those derivatives? Because it seems like those kinds of iterative processes which generate long and complicated polynomials are almost always, I feel like it's where things like Legendre polynomials or something pop up. Thank you.
I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I need this as, okay, this is what you need to do to just do the calculation, but I would say there's not, because again, it's discrete. The good news and bad news about discrete is that there's much less of that, because again, the x1 and the x2 are themselves complicated functions of the parameter. So even though, so the point is that you have, you have this form and it's simple. The point is that x1 and x2 are themselves at this point, sort of 2 to the n degree polynomials that are, so you sort of don't expect to have any simple analytic form. Okay. But in some sense, that's what sort of the amazing thing is, that you take this thing and then it looks like completely helpless, and then the whole point of the renormalization group bit is to then be able to say something nice and clean and analytic and sweet about this thing that just looks sort of, like hopelessly intractable just by looking at it a different way. So that's the thing. It starts off really simple, but at this point, again, the degree of the polynomial is such that it's essentially, impossible to make analytic progress in this fashion. Okay. But then the idea is to do this to see there are these regularities that you can understand using the renormalization group. So that's sort of the point of the thing. Okay, so there is one more thing that I forgot about. Okay, so the remaining thing is the starting guess. All right, so basically here is our mu, okay, and then again we're looking for the superstable point, and so we know that you can just calculate analytically that the superstable point of the period 1 orbit is at mu equals 2. Okay, so this is n equals 1. So again, these are the superstable values. Okay. And you can do the period 2 orbit analytically also, particularly in Mathematica if you wanted to. I mean, you basically, you have the formula for f prime, f prime of x1, f prime of x2, you multiply them together, you set it equal to 0, and then you solve for the you have it's sort of a pain, but you can do it. Okay, but anyway, but it doesn't matter. So we just say, oh, okay, but even not knowing that, n equals 1, this is, sorry, this is 2. Okay, this is 0, this is 2. This is n equals 1. Okay, so, but the thing you do know is that we already computed the stability of the period to orbit, and it's sort of stable between 3 and 3.57. Okay, I guess it's like here. Okay, so, well, it must be in between those two values, so you know you can sort of make it 3.2 or something, or you can compute it. You know, you can decide. Okay, and so then the other thing that you want to know is this is n equals 2. All right. Then the other thing, which is sort of the point of the whole business, is it converges geometrically so basically they say, oh, all right. You want to do pretty well, but you want a the series converges geometrically. So I have super stable of n, and then basically a good guess is to take the old value. Okay, and again the trick is that you want to make sure that you're moving it to larger mu, because you know the value of mu equals 2. Is a superstable orbit, satisfies this condition of, you know, df dx is equal to 0. It's just that it's not stable, right? So basically, you want the largest value of mu for which you can satisfy the equation. So you take the old one, and then you got to add something to it. But the amount that you add, because we happen to know that the thing obeys scaling, it's going to be what, you know, the difference between that value and the previous value, and then it's going to go down by a geometric factor. Okay, and this factor, eventually we will compute, and it's 4.669. I mean, and it's known to, I think, you know, like 60 digits, or maybe 100 and something digits. Okay, it's a universal constant, and but that's sort of the whole point. So this is your starting guess. Okay, so basically you take, you know n equals 1, you know n equals 2 pretty well, or you can find it. And then if you know n equals 1 and n equals 2, then you use that to find n equals 3, and then you just go. And then when you have n equals 3, then you use that to get n equals 4. Okay, so is that clear what you're supposed to do? Okay, all right, so I'm looking at the time, and I think I'll do this sort of, I wrote up some slides on computational complexity to try to introduce you to that, but I think it's not quite enough time to go through them, so I'll do them tomorrow. Okay, and so I think what I'll do instead is just sort of tell you what you're going to find. I was going to stop here, but I thought I would be faster, and yeah. Yeah.
And they're increasing value geometrically. Does that tell us that the bifurcation points also follow some sort of, like, why does that give us any information about bifurcation?
Oh, okay. So going back to the bifurcation diagram.
That's what's interesting.
Yeah. So let me look, I'm glad you asked, because this is exactly, that tells me that I should tell you what, why it matters. Okay, so let me just go back to the bifurcation diagram, okay? And there are two dimensions in the bifurcation diagram, okay? All right, and so this thing that you're computing, okay, and you'll get the other one for free, because in order to do this calculation, you actually find the orbit, right, because you find that, you know, you're saying, oh, okay, well, I take my function, and, you know, once you found mu, then you just take f of x to the n times, and you've got your orbit for free, right? Okay, so what's happening is that the values of mu, okay, there's a point in mu. This thing's called mu infinity, which is the accumulation point of the sequence. It's a geometric sequence, and it's always accumulating. Okay. And so the statement is that if I blow up this direction by, just so you know, the the exponent is known and it's trade is delta, and I think that's right. I'm really bad at numbers. Just checking and I wrote it all down. Yes, I got it right. Okay, so you blow up in this direction about this point, and it looks the same. Okay, so in this direction, what this is, what the accumulation is a sign of scaling in this direction. And again, it's about the accumulation point. So it's exactly analogous to a phase transition, right, where there is here, this is the chaotic phase, and this is the non-chaotic phase. And so this is the transition to chaos, okay? And so the accumulation of these values is very similar to, say, if you have a magnet and you're putting, we'll do the Ising model. I know that you did the Ising model, but don't worry, I won't quiz you. And then you put on a magnetic field, right? If you have a magnetic field, then there's no real phase transition because it's always magnetized to some degree. But as you lower the magnetic field, then at some point, you know, if you cross TC in the presence of a magnetic field, then what happens is that sort of you go from you get a crossover, and then as you lower the magnetic field, you get a phase transition. And so that the exponent delta is analogous to that crossover exponent. Okay. But there's also another direction, all right? And that is the direction of the orbits, okay? And so what happens is that you can look at the orbit itself, okay? And this is, in some sense, you will be stuck doing this, okay? And it turns out the orbit itself is scaling and looks the same when you blow it up, okay? And so the point is that critical exponents are all statements about scale invariance, okay? And so, and this is sort of, in some sense, a connection to field theory, where essentially when you're doing a field theory, you're always sort of assuming invariance, conformal invariance or scale invariance, and then using that to derive the properties of the theory, okay? And what happens here is that there's sort of an underlying sort of equation that you're looking at, which has a point that has these invariances, and then the rest of the business is to show you that if you know that invariance exists, then you can compute what the exponents are that you don't need to know anything about the equation, but the fact that it's scale invariant is enough that you can compute quantitatively these exponents. Okay, so let me go back to here. So what happens is you have these things, and now, you know, so the point is that if I blow up along mu infinity, in this direction, by this factor, it looks the same. Well, I can do the same thing in the x direction. I can take the sig, and if I blow it up by a different factor, so this is in the mu direction, and in the x direction, there's another scale factor, which is called alpha, which is 2.50-something. 2.5029. Okay, and it has the same property. So you blow it up along x, and it looks the same, okay? And again, I have like a couple pictures in the notes, but the point is that, you know, we're making you do this so that you see it's really true and see how to compute them, okay? So the fact that it's invariant when you blow it up is the critical, is the crucial observation. Okay. And what's happening here is, again, you're seeing the analog of, probably the best analog here is to say to finite size scaling. Because what you've got is you're getting, you know, if you have a magnet and it's at the critical point and you put it in a finite size box, I mean, it's the phase transition isn't there. But as you make the box bigger and bigger and bigger, there's scaling behavior with the size of the box. And what's happening here is that you have your orbit, and as you make the length of the orbit longer and longer and longer, you're getting closer and closer to that critical point. Okay? Are there any other questions? Yeah. You get to see, in some sense, this is why we make you do it. So you get to see exactly what's invariant. I'll do the simple case that, again, you're going to be stuck doing all of this. But this is why it's such great material, because you know, you can, you, it's so simple to program it up that you can actually see what's in there yourself. But, okay, so first this, there's this, this geometric convergence of the parameter values. It's like a clue, you know, say, aha, what, no. Okay, but here's like an example that I have in the notes and which I'm going to use to derive the renormalization group equation, so I might as well browbeat you with it. Okay, so here is J, and here is X, and here is a half. Okay? Now, so what you can do is, once you know that this thing accumulates at this value of mu infinity, okay, what you can do is you know, with the benefit of hindsight, you can say, well, let's just look at the critical point itself, okay? Because that's the scale invariant point, in some sense, that's the easiest thing to deal with because it's just the critical point, okay? So what you can do then is you can just sort of take your map and just set mu is equal to mu infinity, which is equal to 3.5, whatever it is, okay? You start off at x equals a half, because again, we have this whole sequence of superstable orbits that all start off at x equal half, so why not start off at x equals a half? And then you get a time series, okay? And now you're at the critical point, and okay, so because you're at the critical point, it turns out the exponent delta doesn't show up yet. It's there, but it's not. You don't see it in the time series, okay? And to see where you get delta is like, it's a whole lecture, right? So we'll get there eventually. But so ignore delta. It turns out the function you can see is alpha, because alpha is the thing that describes the spatial scaling at the critical point. All right, so here you go. This is drawn really badly, okay? Okay, but now what you can do is, and again, I really encourage you to do this, okay, because the whole point of teaching you dynamical systems at some level is that, you know, all of this happens in more complicated contexts, but here you can just compute everything trivially, okay? So what you're going to do is you still take x equals a half, but now you plot every other point, all right? And, well, let me see if I can do it. It's this, and then this, and okay. And it turns out, let me be clear. Okay, you got to blow it up, and it turns out the amount you got to blow it up. Let me be really precise. I'll tell you the exact actually what you do. You blow it up by alpha, but then you also have to flip it. Okay, so it turns out that then this goes from. So I'm not going to flip it, but we'll just say, we'll plot one minus x. So you plot x here, you plot one minus x here, and that just, you know, has the property of it, you know, that you're going about a half, but that it flips the curve, okay? And if you do it, it looks the same, okay? Okay? And then you can take every fourth point. So this is every other. You can do every fourth point, and now you're back to plotting x, okay? And it looks the same, okay? And that's the sense that, okay, so if I say, you know, so if I take this and blow it up appropriately, it's scale invariant. The series itself, you take every other point and you blow it up, looks the same as if you take every point, okay? Now, I'll go again through this in more detail, but sort of the time is such so I can just sort of get you on the, you know, sort of set you on the path of, okay. So then you can, and so then the statement is that at the critical point, the time series is scale invariant. And it turns out that the amount you blow it up by is this exponent alpha, okay? And so now the next statement is that if you take another function, if I took the sine function, if you take any one-dimensional map, you know, and again, there's some long series of criteria that, you know, general criteria that anything will satisfy. Well, it turns out you do the same thing and you find the critical point and you find that it looks like it's scale invariant, and then you blow it up and it looks the same and the scale factor is the same scale factor. And so you could ask the question, well, how can that be? These are different functions, okay? Well, and the answer to that question is, if you look in detail, which again, since you can program it up and it's so simple, it's easy for you to do. It turns out that like if you look from every point to every other point, it looks the same, but it's not exactly the same. Okay, there are errors, all right? And in fact, the reason why it looks the same is just because these exponents are pretty big, right? You know, so you converge to the universal function pretty fast, just because the fact that these exponents have big values means that, you know, all the perturbations sort of die away pretty fast, okay? But then if you compare it to the second to the fourth, the scaling gets better. I mean, even, you know, you blow them up and put them on the same scale and you'll see that the deviation from perfect scaling goes down. And if you go from the fourth to the eighth, then again, the scaling becomes better. And from the eighth, between 8 and 16, it gets yet better. And so asymptotically, in the limit where you're looking at, you know, very long scales, it's asymptotically perfect. And that's the sense in which these different functions are exactly the same, okay? The functions themselves are different, but they're sort of governed by a universal function that is the same for all the different functions. So that even though you don't know what the function is when you started because everything's governed by this other universal function, there are these quantitative things you can say. And in particular, you can compute the scale factor without ever iterating the function. You can find the exponents themselves, you will be stuck finding them, you know, again, not by iterating the function, but rather by solving the renormalization group equation. Okay. And again, when you do field theory or, you know, StatMech or critical phenomena or whatever, what happens is that, you know, the sort of straightforward, here it is, here's the scaling, you can just compute it and see that it's true, you don't do because the system itself is so complicated that, you know, you're not going to be able to do that in any sort of simple way. But here you can do the actual, here's the system and simulate it and see that it's actually true. And so then when you solve the renormalization group equation, you can see that it really works and see how much easier it is in terms of getting the numbers out. And so then when you do the more complicated systems, you just take the renormalization group or you assume conformal invariance and then, you know, it will imply certain things. And again, here you can actually do the whole kit and caboodle. And that's why it's pedagogically so useful. Because you can really see the underpinnings that, you know, it's not just that you write down an action and, you know, here is the result, but rather you see that you could do it in the stupid way and get the right answer. It's just that it's so much easier to use the symmetries of the system, to use the scale invariance itself. Okay? Now is that clear? Okay. All right, so let me just look at my notes to make sure that you have everything you need to do this. Okay. Let me just say one other thing about the scaling and the bifurcation diagram itself. Okay. So for me, this is the way I like to think about alpha is parked at lambda, mu infinity. But I should tell you that the derivation of the renormalization group equation that I'm going to do, again, I'll do my little diversion tomorrow, partly because I know that you will not have, you know, you won't have done this, and you're not having a tutorial today. And so, you know, I wanted to go a little more slowly. So there's going to be a diversion tomorrow, but then after that, I'm going to then pick up and start on the renormalization group equation, and I'm going to drive it a different way, which I find much much simpler, and which sort of follows directly from here. Okay. But Feigenbaum didn't do it this way. Okay, I think it's much simpler, and you'll see the way I did. And you, if you want, you can go back and see what he did. But his way of getting alpha he didn't actually look at the time series. He looked at this diagram. Okay, and so one way to see it is you can sort of park yourself. Again, the starting off at the superstable point is, you know, sort of the key here. But again, what happens if you have an orbit of period 2 to the n? What's that mean? You go and then you come back and then x 2 to the n is equal to x. Okay. When you've period doubled that orbit, then what happens is it means that that point failed to come back. Okay. But then you go 2 to the n more and then you do come back. That's what the period doubled orbit is. And so the point which is closest to the top of it, so if you have an orbit of period 2 to the n, okay, and you start at x equals a half, the point that comes the closest is, yeah, I don't know, I forget which side it's on. This is this qualitative universality that I can't remember. Okay, this one is, this is x to the 2 to the n minus 1. It's the halfway point, okay? And you can ask the question, okay, so what is this? This is x, and, you know, and I drew f of x there just to, you know, for effect, okay? So you can say, well, okay, the orbit fails to close until you hit 2 to the n, but what's the point of closest approach? Okay, and that's sort of this distance here. Okay, and it turns out that distance scales with n. It goes like 1 over alpha. You know, it goes n to the alpha, where alpha has this value. Okay, and you can, you know, and so you can either view it as something which is a property of the critical point itself, which is, I think, much simpler, okay, and will be very useful for deriving the renormalization group equation, or you can, you know, but again, Feigenbaum, if you go back and read his papers, which, you know, is always a good thing to do, to read the original papers, even if, I mean, he's sort of hard to follow, but it's all there, okay. He wasn't thinking in terms of the critical point itself. He always thought in terms of the whole sequence. Okay, and so when he derived the renormalization group equation, he did it, you know, using properties of the entire sequence. And so, you know, so everything he did was in property, you know, was couched in terms of finite period orbits. Okay, and so in terms of that, in terms of the approach to the critical point, that's what it was. It was sort of the distance of halfway around the orbit to from the starting point when you started at x equals a half. And that's the thing that scaled with the exponent alpha in his formulation. So that's the thing you see on the bifurcation diagram. Okay, but again, I think it's sort of easier to think about alpha just by sort of parking at the critical point and looking there. Okay, all right, so I think that's it. I mean, so now you're ready. They have everything to do their homework, right? Okay, and again, next time because you now have everything to do your homework, I'm going to, then, since people hadn't heard about the computational complexity, I'll take a little bit of a lecture and tell you a little bit about that, because I think it's really worth knowing. And then I'll pick up on this, on the renormalization group part of it. Okay?